Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's been said that you don't know what you can't see. So let's try to envision something different, a thought exercise, if you will. If you could rehabilitate American democracy for the 21st century, what would it look like? What institutions and norms would you keep, those central pillars? What would you change, and why would you change those specific things? What would they do to restore the civil compact between citizens and their government? How would those changes make American democracy stronger, more resilient, and a shining beacon once more for the 21st century? Well, this thought exercise isn't just a lark. Danielle Allen has actually done it. She is a professor and political theorist at Harvard University and director of Harvard's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. And she's also co-chair of a major report from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. It was recently released. It's titled Our Common Purpose, Reinventing American Democracy for the 21st Century. And Professor Allen joins us now. Welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Good to be with you again.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, actually. Thank you for asking. You have been working very hard recently. We didn't talk to you all that long ago about creating a plan that wove together democracy and public health to fight the pandemic. And here we are again, reimagining American democracy with you. So first and foremost, when the American Academy of Arts and Sciences convened this panel of thinkers from across the spectrum, why is it that there was the thought that this exercise even needed to be done, that American democracy needed to be reimagined in some way?
There were lots of flashing red alerts about our democracy and have been already for years. So in 2013, for example, Congress's approval rating hit 9%. The legislature is the first branch of government. It is the people's voice. It has the job of articulating the will of the people. If the people doesn't approve its own voice, then you know that your democracy is fundamentally broken. Congress's approval ratings have, of course, gone back up, but not to higher than about 30%. So that in itself is its own flashing alarm sign. There's also the data on how young people think about democracy. So for people under 40, slightly under 30% consider it essential to live in a democracy. And again, I mean, it's just very, very basic. You can't have a democracy if people don't want one. So if you have rising generations that do not consider democracy essential, you have a flashing red alert sign. So I could go down the list. There are the red alerts around polarization. There are the red alerts around levels of distrust in our national governments. So there's so many different indicators that suggested that it's time to dig deep and really consider how we organize our society and deliver on basic promises of constitutional democracy.
Hmm. So then how do you even begin this exercise? I mean, you're talking about the basic, as you just said, the basic relationship between residents and citizens and their government. So where did you begin?
Well, you know, it's not that much of a mystery in the sense that this country has a habit of reconsidering its own situation. Just think back to the period between the Revolution and the Constitutional Convention, where things were sort of obviously broken. The federal government couldn't fund its debts. You had unrest across the new states of the new country. And a group of legislators sort of gathered quietly in Annapolis, Maryland to say, hey, we think this thing's really broken. Is it time for a deeper conversation? And the result of that was the Constitutional Convention. So in a similar spirit, we gathered people from across all sectors of society and said, hey, let's consider this. Do you also have the sense that something's really broken? And sure enough, everybody did. And so then we did the things that usually happen in a commission. That is, we commissioned research, we did literature reviews and so forth. But in addition, we thought that the most important thing to do is to talk to Americans all over the country and get their take on what was working and what wasn't working. So we organized listening and engagement conversations all over the country. seeking to understand why people weren't participating in the government, where they thought their frustrations lay, what the sources were. And so that gave us a chance to build out a diagnosis.
Mm. Okay, so there's some interesting stories then to be pulled out of just that that research that you did in talking to Americans. Can you tell us, for example, you did a session in Lowell, Massachusetts. Who did you talk to and what did you learn?
So in Lowell, Massachusetts, we had incredible, powerful, moving conversations with a community organization of Cambodian refugees, now citizens. So people who've been in this country for a very long time, but came here in the wake of the terror of the Khmer Rouge and so forth. And it was really, I mean, one of some of the most moving conversations I've ever had in my life, both in terms of the articulation of the kind of profound value they see and have experienced as members of this constitutional democracy, the protections of freedom, the opportunities to secure a life for themselves without terror, without the fear of terror. Yet they also expressed frustrations. They expressed efforts to connect with local government or with Congress and the difficulty of accessing the information that they needed, the difficulty of forming meaningful and effective relationships with elected officials. So there was simultaneously this recognition of the profound value of what constitutional democracy promises and the need for all of us to be committed to it, but also a sense that institutionally, the institutions weren't fully delivering. They weren't providing responsiveness. They weren't actually fully providing empowerment. They weren't providing equal representation.
Wow. And to hear that, that both sort of love for this country and frustration, as you just said, from immigrants who fled Pol Pot in Cambodia is quite something. Now, you also talk to people who are non-voters as well?
Yep, exactly. We didn't want to just sort of, you know, talk to the people who are already civically engaged. We wanted to really find out what's keeping people from engaging. And there, I mean, the stories, even across really diverse contexts, were very, very consistent. So in the first instance, if you asked folks, you know, what do they think that they shared with other Americans, the answer was nothing. So we had this sort of paradoxical situation where we found that what we shared was the belief that we shared nothing. And yet, at the same time that people were expressing that kind of disconnection from one another, they also, across the board, all kinds of contexts, use a vocabulary of rights and responsibilities. They cared about their rights. They cared about having their rights protected, securing their rights. And they also recognized responsibilities. I was honestly quite surprised by how frequently we heard people invoke the responsibility to pay taxes as core to their definition of what it means to be an American or be a civic participant, be a citizen, and so forth. So across the board, all kinds of contexts, people thought that we shared nothing, but actually kept articulating the shared commitment to the sort of package of rights and responsibilities that make the bedrock of constitutional democracy.
That is absolutely fascinating. And Professor Allen, if I may, it actually gives me a great amount of hope, because maybe this is one of the illnesses in the media. We don't talk enough about how there is still a sense of shared responsibility.
Honestly, I think that's true. And we spent some of our time talking about the media and trying to think through what would a different media ecosystem look like. For me, the result of that was just sort of this discovery based on an example coming out of Lexington, Kentucky, of the fact that we could invent something we might call civic media instead of social media. So if you think of social media as more or less, you know, something like middle school, civic media is the place where we can use those same tools and platforms and actually deliver the kind of conversation and interaction that we need for effective governance and for a culture of mutual commitment. So the specific example I have in mind is an organization in Lexington, Kentucky called Civic Lex. And they use all the sort of tools of social media, multimedia, and so forth to support investigative journalism locally on things like local city council budgets, the county level, you know, so policy around water management, things like that. They really seek to educate and inform, to fill that sort of void of explanatory and investigative journalism at the local level that has emerged in the last 15 years. We now live in a country populated by news deserts. You know, we're used to talk about food deserts. We just as well have news deserts. And so they filled that void. But in addition to filling that void by just supporting, getting good explanatory, good investigative journalism to the highest standards, they have used the sort of social media element of their platforms to build conversation spaces. And they have a principle whereby they build in-person events as well as forms of online connection. And for those in-person events, they bring public officials, whether elected or appointed, together with members of the local community, with never more than 7 people per official. And there's something brilliant in that, because what they're really doing is foregrounding the importance of relationships.
Right.
The fact that as we gather information, we do investigative journalism, we deliberate about the direction for our community, we actually need to know each other as a part of doing that work. And although we're this mass society, you know, we're in this incredible place where we are, you know, divided, we're something like 4,300 counties across the country, and no county is too big to start thinking about how to restore relationality. And then go down below the level of the county, the level of the municipality. And imagine if we could make it a kind of basic principle that as we rebuild local journalism, local information resources, we connect that to a project of relationship building on that scale of 1 public official to every 7 people.
Well, Professor Allen, so that's actually one of the recommendations that the report has. We're going to explore more of them in the remainder of the show. But if you can just hang on for a second, I want to bring in Jack Beatty, who is the On Point News analyst. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Magda.
Hi, Jack. So I did not manage this segment as well as I should have. We've only got about a minute before our first break, but I just wanted to allow you to get us started on sort of what are some of the big themes that Professor Allen and her colleagues are pointing to that we should be engaging with.
Well, I think the main theme, and she's emphasized it eloquently now, is reinvention. The report talks about the refounding of the country after the Civil War, the second founding with the passage of the Freedom Amendments, a third founding in the Civil Rights Movement. And in the time this was being printed, there may be an inchoate fourth founding going on in the streets, that is, in the Black Lives protest movement.
Right. So Jack, actually, I know you've got more to say on that. And let me just take a quick break, and I'll let you finish when we come back. We are talking about a new report from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences called Our Commission, Our Common Purpose, Reinventing American Democracy for the 21st Century. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're asking if American democracy is to be revitalized, what would that look like? And Danielle Allen joins us today. She's co-chair of a new report released by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. That report is titled Our Common Purpose, Reinventing American Democracy for the 21st Century. She's also a professor at Harvard University as well. And Jack Beatty joins us. He's On Point's news analyst. And Jack, you before the break, you were talking about reflecting on the report and how it talks about the sort of multiple foundings of America. Do you see, Jack, what's happening in the streets right now over the course of this month as a fourth founding?
Well, it certainly seems to have the legs to be one. I mean, in the way it endures and in the change in public opinion, just dramatic change in public opinion from Ferguson, Missouri to today and what white people think about policing in America. A shift of over 25 points, almost unheard of. So the attention of the country has been got. Now, it's true that the protesters in the street, they're not marching for, you know, ranked order voting or any of the specifics in this report, but there's an energy out there, and this report, I think, is instinct with that energy, and it's overall the things it calls for: equality of voice, empowerment of voters, bridging ties across lines of difference, and a change in political culture. You can see these values and energies at work in the Black Lives Matter protest and in the wider American protest about inequality. So the moment for this report may have arrived.
Professor Allen, did you want to respond to that?
I agree. I think Jack has put it very well. The protests in the street, the direct actions, the demonstrations are directed against the abuse of power. And in that regard, they are also positively directed at a world in which we share power effectively, in which there is a basic culture of respect for human beings, for all one's fellow members of society. They are making the point that when those at the worst end of disadvantage are not treated with respect and humanity, that's bad for everybody. So Black lives matter, because if we pay attention to how we are actually providing respect and security for those who are least well off, we know we're achieving it for everybody.
Yeah.
So without any question, I think that the grievances being elevated, the vision for a forward path is very much in alignment with our goals of equal empowerment, equal voice, as Jack was saying, responsiveness in our political institutions, a civil society that enables us to bridge divides, and a culture of mutual commitment.
So one thing which you told Professor Allen, which you told our producer before, in the process of preparing for this hour, is you pointed to the Declaration of Independence itself, and that in the language of the Declaration, there is the fundamental presumption or statement, I should say, that one of the duties of government is to protect the governed, right? And that we in a democracy we entrust the power to the government to do that. And so what we're seeing here is a break in that compact, right? That the governed do not feel protected by their own government.
Correct. I mean, it's important to remember, that the American Revolution started in grievances about the abuse of police power. The writs of assistance, for example, a key issue here in Boston, was about the customs officers having been given sort of power to search without any kind of probable cause or limitation on how their searching power would be exercised. So police power, abuse of police power, was at the core of the picture of rights that ought to be protected sketched out by the early American founders. And yeah, so in the Declaration of Independence, what they sketched was precisely a social compact, namely that we, the people, invest our public officials with power in order that they secure our rights. So if they use power not to secure our rights, by definition, they've broken the basic promise that our whole system rests upon.
Right. And this goes beyond policing, I'd say. Like, people feel that the government is not protecting a multiplicity of their rights to life, right? To enfranchisement, to representation. I mean, that's sort of the fundamental fragility of the democracy that we're living in right now, that you were talking about earlier in the show.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, please. Well, I was just going to observe that one of the striking things about the pandemic and the response to COVID is, if you look around the world, there are democracies that have succeeded at responding to COVID. Australia succeeded. Germany succeeded. New Zealand succeeded. Taiwan succeeded. South Korea succeeded. Now, what links the democracies that succeeded and the ones that didn't? So who didn't? The US has not succeeded. The United Kingdom has not succeeded. Italy didn't do well. France didn't do well. The young democracies have done just fine. The old democracies, the sclerotic democracies, where we no longer have the kind of flexibility and resilience that is about empowerment and responsiveness and equal representation. Those are the democracies that have failed to govern through the pandemic effectively.
Wow. Jack, what a thing it is to think of the United States as an old sclerotic democracy.
Yeah, how does that fit with our idea of being able to reinvent ourselves? But, I just have a question that I'd like to put Professor Allen. I was struck with the things you call, well, let's put it this way. The Democrats, when they won the House in January 2019, they passed a bill called For the People Act. It included expansion of early voting, automatic voter registration, public financing of some kind for elections, election day as a national holiday. It wanted to restrict redistricting by independent commissions, ending gerrymandering, exposing 501c4 profit, in other words, exposing dark money in politics, and on and on. Now, these are all measures you call for in your report. And it was put to a vote in the House of Representatives, these were. Every Democrat voted for the expansion of democracy you call for, every Republican voted against it. Isn't that a tremendous barrier to reform, that the Republican Party does not want to expand democracy?
You have to look very closely at the relationship between what was in H.R. 1 and our report. The relationship is as much about what's not in our report as about what's in it. So H.R. 1 had lots of good ideas in it, some better than others. And our commission was formed out of a wide range of people representing views across the ideological spectrum. So we made it a principle of our work that we would advocate for reforms and changes for which there was already meaningful evidence of support across ideological or party lines. So in that regard, our report consists of precisely that cluster of interacting reforms that would have highest impact and that already have the most cross-partisan support. We did not, for example, recommend getting rid of the Electoral College, a position that many Democratic candidates in the primary took. And you can find other things like that where we made decisions not to endorse views that are very much subscribed to in some parts of our political landscape. So our report does have a lot of material in it that is also in H.R. 1, but there's also a lot in H.R. 1 that is not in our report.
So I just want to say that we're talking about reimagining, reinvigorating American democracy and what institutions need to be changed and revitalized, what institutions and practices we need to preserve. And I want to hear from listeners about their ideas. Now, Jack, your point is well taken, and I do want to come back to it actually a little later in the program, because we do need to discuss which one of the commission's proposals might need to eventually be funneled through Congress. But before we do that, Professor Allen, let's just dig into a couple of specifics in more detail in what the commission recommends. So first of all, for example, tell us more about this idea of expanding the House of Representatives, adding what, at least 50 members?
Sure. So the House was capped in some sense arbitrarily about a century ago. Originally, the expectation was of a much tighter sort of proportional ratio of representatives to their constituents. Of course, the population kept growing. And there's no reason, though, in constitutional principle or anything else, that we shouldn't lift the cap again. In fact, over time, from generation to generation, Congress did increase the size of the House. So there's with the new census, they would introduce an act to increase the size of the House. So we are overdue for revisiting the question of the size of the House. That question also interacts with the issue of the Electoral College, insofar as the Electoral College is structured in terms of its numbers, based on the numbers of people in the House plus numbers of people in the Senate. We have lived through this important demographic shift in the country where we have transitioned from being a majority rural country to being a majority urban country. And with that shift, the relative sort of weighting of the value of a vote in a kind of rural location versus urban location has skewed too far. So what increasing the size of the House does is rebalance to some degree. That weighting that puts a bit more weight on votes coming out of the less populous states goes back, of course, to the founding structure of the Constitution. It's a compromise. It's an important and valuable compromise. A constitutional democracy is not equivalent to a majority vote. A majority vote is one tool in the toolkit of a constitutional democracy. constitutional democracies also need minority protecting mechanisms. Otherwise, there's no point in minorities participating in a democracy. So you need a blend of tools to achieve a balance of power across subsets of a society. And the Electoral College delivers that minority protecting element to less populous parts of our country. That weighting in favor of those less populous minorities had gone too far. It was too much of a weight. So it's time to rebalance it, pull it back. And that's what increasing the size of the House achieves.
Okay. So here's actually one point where we get right back to the question that Jack asked, because you're referring, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're referring to the 1929 Permanent Apportionment Act, right? That capped the size of the House at 435 members.
Right.
Okay. And so in the report, writes that means that now each congressperson represents, well, I guess in populous districts, over 747,000 constituents. Okay. So that's a lot. More than the 30,000 constituents per representative that's actually in the Constitution. So to undo that, to increase the size of the House, to either repeal or update the Permanent Apportionment Act, that is one of the things that would have to go through Congress, would it not? And so, to back to Jack's point, you said these were bipartisan ideas presented in the report, but I'm not sure there's bipartisan support for that in the halls of Congress.
Sure. So it's a fair point that in our broad civil society, there is, a range of ideological positions and party affiliations. And people not in elected office can converge around things despite disagreements about other parts of our policy landscape. That challenge, or is it that the work of convergence is harder for elected officials, it's harder for incumbents who want to protect whatever structure it was that got them elected most recently. So all those things are true, that having Congress act on this is a harder thing. That said, the question of who would benefit over the long term from this kind of adjustment is up in the air. Mm. So in that regard, it's not a sort of straightforwardly clear question of it's being to the benefit of one party or the other. Same can be said about redistricting. It's not actually clear that there's any sort of permanent beneficiary in one party or the other. So in that regard, there's an opening. And indeed, if you have quiet conversations with members of Congress from both parties, you will hear them too express dissatisfaction with how our institutions are functioning. And if you can get them in that space and get them to sort of ruminate out loud about who across the aisle could they have a conversation with this about, you discover that there are people they could talk to about this. So we have the seeds of possibility. So the question is then, how do you take the seeds of possibility and turn them into something real? And that depends on the people. That depends on we, the people. We have all seen an incredible transformation in the last 6 weeks. The Colorado State Legislature, for example, just voted through some reforms related to policing and criminal justice with only one dissenting vote. In other words, purely bipartisan embrace of a set of reforms in a way that would have been unthinkable 6 months ago. So we, the people, as our opinions change, as our action as civic agents, civic participants, citizens change, we change the horizons of the possible. Mm-hmm. So if our politicians are stuck, that's because we're letting them stay stuck. We don't have to do that.
Jack, what do you think?
I think this is a valuable insight, the connection between political culture and politics. And I think if I hear you correctly, Professor, you're saying changes in political culture, in the habits of the heart, as you say, in the things that Americans think and feel about public life, those can change politics. And in some ways, political culture may be more open to change than electoral politics. But in any case, there's a sort of virtuous cycle that you could set going where what people want in what they come to want through changes in political culture get ratified by politics. Politics, in turn, seems more legitimate to political culture, and you have a happy... it sounds like nirvana today, but that's the idea.
Exactly. Now you've put your finger on it exactly. So there was a point in our process about 6 months into our work where we had this kind of aha moment. We realized that over the years, there have been plenty of people who have worked on specific reforms to our political institutions. And in a separate lane altogether, there have been plenty of people following sort of in the wake of Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone work, who have worked on civil society organizations and how to rebuild connective tissue among us. And then again, altogether separately, there have been plenty of people who have worked on questions of, say, civic education or civic culture and political culture. But what had never happened was that this work be done together and in a symbiotic relationship. And you've put your finger on it exactly. You can't have functioning political institutions unless you have a political culture that actually is asking for them and that also supports people's commitment to participating in them. But similarly, you can't actually have that healthy culture if your institutions don't deserve it. So you've got to get things interacting productively together.
Well, you know, in the commission's report, they include quotations from people that that you all talk to across the country. And one of them from Ellsworth, Maine is, "Some folks feel the voices that count the most are those that have the power. And when I'm at my most negative, I feel the same way. But democracy is all about voices counting. So how do we get those people to believe that we can make that change?" We're going to talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking with Danielle Allen. She is the director of Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics and co-chair of a new report released by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences titled Our Common Purpose, Reinventing American Democracy for the 21st Century. Jack Beattie is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. And together, and also with you listeners, we are, as Professor Allen puts it, trying to reimagine the possible horizons for what American democracy ought to look like in the 21st century. We talked about maybe expanding the House of Representatives before the break. Ranked choice voting was mentioned as well. The commission has interesting ideas about maybe having the option for multi-member districts in some House districts on the condition that those districts adopt a non-winner-take-all election model. Absolutely fascinating idea. Campaign finance also comes up. And so on that point about money and politics, let's go to Bill, who's calling from Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. That's the first I've heard about money in politics was your last statement. I've been listening for the whole show. I don't think it's that complicated to begin with. Get money out of politics. Get money out of politics. We need federally financed elections. We need no lobbying gifts. We need no dark money. The reason people aren't involved in politics is because they don't believe, unless they have a lot of money, that they have anything to say. The second thing we need is an economic system where everyone has economic dignity, because we can't have people who are interested in government when they're scrubbing for food, when they're trying to put enough on the table to eat, et cetera, et cetera. So we need a change in the government. We need a change in the economic system. And we need equity in both, and we need money out of politics.
Yeah. Bill, thank you for that call. Professor Allen, in the commission's report, you all write that Americans believe that $1, one vote has displaced one person, one vote. So how would you remedy that?
Well, we agree with the gentleman that we need disclosure. We need very strong disclosure. This is work that states can do. So there should not be dark money campaign funding should be disclosed. And so that's a good example of the way in which states can act, even if Congress isn't acting. So that's an important point to recognize, is how many levers for change we have in our system. We also have argued that the one constitutional amendment that we have recommended concerns reversing the impact of Citizens United and reversing the status of corporations as persons protected by the same free speech rights as individuals. So we agree about the importance of restoring voice as the center of our government rather than money. And thank the caller for his comment.
So that's the only constitutional amendment you recommend. Is it the impracticality of changing the Constitution that made the commission sort of unwilling to turn to the foundational document of our democracy as a source for change?
So it's not that we were unwilling to turn to it, but rather that for all 31 recommendations, we set ourselves certain guideposts. We had an interesting conversation early in our process where we debated whether or not our job was to be bold and visionary or to be incremental and really focused on pragmatic reality. And we decided to be both. So we wanted to be sure that all of our recommendations were bold, that they did set out a vision for a stronger, more resilient, fairer democracy. Yet at the same time, for every single recommendation, we wanted to vet it for feasibility. And feasibility, vetting something for feasibility means that you ask yourself the question, what's the least difficult way of achieving this for every single thing? And if there's a pathway that doesn't require a constitutional amendment, we'll take that pathway. So for everything else that we were working on, we found pathways that are realistic, feasible. People are already working on them. There are champions carrying them forward. The one exception was in the space of campaign finance, where it is clear that Citizens United requires attention and response, and that a constitutional amendment is the best path to that.
Interesting. Okay, well, speaking of boldness, let's go to Shane, who's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Shane, how bold do you want to be in reinventing American democracy?
Hey, well, salutations. Thanks for taking my call. I had heard somewhere along the line that it was maybe in the purview of the founders that every 50 years or so, the Constitution would just be rewritten. And although we've obviously amended it significantly since then, here we're talking about all the issues we've got today and all the lessons we've learned getting to this point. At what point do we not just put down a hard reset button and rewrite the Constitution? You know, start from scratch and kind of close the gaps that we all see instead of trying to figure out how to transition a bunch of smaller problems. Is there anything to that? Would that even be reasonable to do? I feel like we need something, I don't want to say extreme, but much more modern, kind of where we've been trying to go today.
Shane, thank you for that call. Professor Allen, what do you think?
Sure. Well, it sounds as if you're invoking the arguments of Thomas Jefferson, who did think that every generation there should be, in some sense, a rewrite. Jefferson was really at one end of a spectrum of opinion on that point, in all honesty. So the founders debated at length the question of how to think about the alteration of political and social institutions. That's a word, alteration, that they used in the Declaration of Independence. And they had a lot of historical examples in front of them. They sort of dug into history and looked for places where free self-government among free and equal citizens had succeeded over time. They looked at Athens, they looked at Rome, they looked at the early modern republics of Venice and the like. In Athens, they were really worried by the rapidity of change. Athens only lasted 200 years, and they chalked this up in part to just how frequently the Athenians were sort of turning everything over. So that, on the other side, there was a sort of long, you know, strong voices arguing for an ongoing need for alteration, but within a context of always carrying existing structures with you as you went. And so in that regard, what they built was really in that space in the middle, where we are given many levers of change, many, many, many levers of change. Every single election is an opportunity for dramatic transformation and redirection. Constitutional amendments are a dramatic opportunity for reinvention. The judicial system, the use of litigation, is a powerful lever of change. So they gave us tons of levers of change and therefore invited us into a continuous process. I think today, from my point of view, the issue is that we, the people, are leaving too many opportunities on the table. The levers are there. We really have to organize ourselves, educate ourselves, and begin pulling them effectively.
Huh. So, Jack, let me turn back to you for a second here, because I am thrilled by Professor Allen's call for we the people to take hold of all the levers that ostensibly exist for us within the machinery of American democracy. But I keep thinking back to what you were saying earlier, and I'll explore this with you. We also at the same time have what seems to be a concerted effort to take the handles of those levers off for many voters, right? I mean, like that's I think on the ground, that's one of the things that people find quite appalling and frustrating.
Yes, voter suppression. And it's we just saw the examples in the Georgia election. We're probably going to see more. The president is trying to gin up a whole panic about voting. And yeah, that's taking the basic handles away. And driving that, I think, is something that David Frum, who's sort of an expert on conservatives, after all, he was a Bush speechwriter, a disturbing sentence he wrote. He wrote, "If conservatives become convinced they cannot win democratically, they will not abandon conservatism. They will abandon democracy." That's what's frightening to me, and I believe it's the case that conservatives can't win democratically. I just don't think you can outlaw abortion. I don't think you could. In other words, it's a minority persuasion. And he's saying here that their commitment to democracy is weaker than their commitment to ideology. That's a danger to our whole system. That's saying one half of the people, or at least a segment of them, maybe ready to check out of this democracy because it can't get what it wants.
Hmm. Well, so go ahead, Professor.
That's exactly why, from my point of view, democracy should be the first thing we're talking about on any policy agenda. And that is why our number one overarching goal should be to rebuild a supermajority of Americans for whom living in a democracy is essential. That is work about civic culture as well as about our institutions. It's back to that virtuous circle. And it does require that we dig in and make the case without any question. But that should be the goal, a supermajority of Americans who are committed to democracy.
Hmm. So can we talk a little bit more then about some of the other recommendations that you make? Because, speaking of the courts, the commission says, why not eliminate lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court? Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So the idea is that there would be term limits, 18-year terms for Supreme Court justices. And so every presidential term, would bring the appointment of two justices. So you'd have a smoothing effect. Every 4 years, two more people would be appointed. And the idea is that this would pull the partisanship out of the judicial appointment process. The judicial process is not supposed to be partisan. It's not supposed to be about one party or the other packing the court with their justices. And currently, given the fact that the Supreme Court seats sort of can be held with the sort of indefinite length, sort of 40 years, 50 years, there's too much power invested in one place, and it's being pulled into our electoral politics. We hear that with every speech President Trump gives. He focuses on that issue of court appointments. It is arguably the thing that made the biggest difference for him in 2016. But this is not specifically about President Trump or a specific partisan point. Both sides have turned judicial appointments into a partisan question. This is very bad for the judiciary. It means they don't have the space and the respect and the legitimacy that they need to be the anchor of our entire system. So take the partisanship out by turning this into a routine process where every president is guaranteed to make two appointments. No president's going to be making more than two appointments, et cetera.
So can I ask, I just want to reiterate that really what we're talking about here is American democracy, small d democracy, right? But the issue of partisanship and the parties has just come up organically and urgently over and over again. I mean, how much of the problem that we're facing now has to do with the fact that so many of the, it seems to me at least, and correct me if I'm wrong, but so many of the machinery of our democracy is actually flowing through a party system like we have.
So that's why one of the most important recommendations is one of the sort of least sexy recommendations. And this is the recommendation for ranked choice voting and multi-member districts at the level of Congress, ranked choice voting sort of throughout our set of political institutions. So this is voting where a voter doesn't just pick one person, but gets to pick their first choice, their second choice, their third choice, and so forth. And if their first choice voter doesn't make it up a certain level, that vote rolls over to their second choice person. Ranked choice voting demonstrably brings out a more diverse slate of candidates. You get a wider ideological range. Candidates have to campaign to be people's second and third choice. And so that reduces the polarization of campaigning. They want to reach more people than just their niche voters. So that, technical and wonky and boring as it sounds, is the key to a fundamental transformation of our electoral system and an escape hatch that can help us get out of the problems of polarization that we currently experience.
So we have seen forms of ranked choice voting tried out in Maine, I believe, right?
Maine, New York City is about to do all of its elections via ranked choice voting. So it's spreading around the country. There are lots of examples. Fair Vote is the leading champion organization on that one. And if you visit their website, you can see all the places around the country that have been adopting ranked choice voting over the last 5 to 6 years.
Okay, interesting. Well, let's take one more call here. Let's go to John, who's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question is, with all these reforms and all this stuff that I've been watching over the last couple of weeks, we're never really addressing the low voter turnout, how America is basically a country that comes together, but we have individual rights. And I don't see many adults exercising the individual rights come voting day. I see plenty of them running to the streets, spray painting and toppling things.
Mm. Well, John, so thank you for that call. Professor Allen, your thoughts on bringing people to the polls?
So we think that voting should be like serving on a jury. We've got jury duty. We should have voter duty. So we do recommend mandatory universal voting. We also think that you can do that in a context where voting is easy. So we also recommend automatic voter registration. We recommend early voting. We recommend a variety of voting methodologies. And we recommend making the federal election day a national holiday, ideally Veterans Day. So we think absolutely we should all embrace the concept of voter duty right alongside jury duty. And we should support exercise and fulfillment of our responsibility as voters with a package of things to make voting maximally easy.
Yeah. Well, Danielle Allen is co-chair of a new report released by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences titled Our Common Purpose, Reinventing American Democracy for the 21st Century. Professor Allen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for the great conversation.
Jack, we've got about a minute left here. I just wanted to ask you, is it not inspiring, even as it's easy to be cynical about the condition of American democracy right now, is it not inspiring to even just go through this mental exercise of imagining what different horizons might be?
It is. And you begin to think, are there moments when the national mind is open to change? This does seem to be such a moment.
I mean, it doesn't actually seem to be out of the realm of possibility. Some of the things that Professor Allen is talking about, as she mentioned, they were discussed in the presidential primaries, whereas 4 or 8 years ago, people would have been laughed off the stage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All of this sort of thing, ranked choice voting. I mean, people are open to hearing alternatives. And here's a menu of them.
Well, Jack Beattie is On Point's news analyst with us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Megna.
All right. And we have links to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences report. Those links are at onpointradio.org. Definitely check it out. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.